I'm going to a town that has already been burnt down. Yeah. I'm going to a place that has already been disgraced. I'm gonna see some folks who have already been let down. I'm so tired of America. I'm gonna make it up for all of the Sunday times, yeah. I'm gonna make it up for all of the
to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes of the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, The Damned, 1975, Bob Dylan, Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. Today we're joined by the multi-instrumentalist, producer, vocalist and songwriter Jack Petrozelli, who amongst a plethora of gifted artists has recorded and toured with the likes of the enigmatic Patti Smith and Rufus Wainwright, as well as doing something the Beatles never quite managed, which was to coordinate a live performance of the Abbey Road medley, 16 minutes of complex and detached unfinished songs that were recorded separately by the Beatles and was impressively pulled off by Jack's Beatles tribute band the Fab Four in one take, and has been seen by a quarter of a million times on YouTube to huge acclaim, about 50,000 of which I'm responsible for because I love it. We're going to be discussing all that, the evolution of production techniques. Jack will be reflecting on his career and passing on his wisdom to young musicians entering the industry. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Jack Petrozelli. Thanks for joining us today, Jack. How's it going?
Hey, Chris. It's going well. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. So you're in Miami at the moment and we're recording this via Skype. We just touched upon the Abbey Road medley there. You said to me in an email earlier that you did another recent recording a couple of weeks ago. Was that Beatles related as well?
Totally. We just did the Fab Four, went back to Sirius, and we did a four-song recording session live. We did Within You, Without You, Rain, Strawberry Fields, Lady Madonna.
Okay, excellent. And I mean, the Fab Four are kind of known for the fact that you nail a lot of stuff that is really some of the most complex stuff as mentioned. In regards to the Abbey Road medley, that's such a complex piece of music. Talk us through a bit of that process, because I mean, it's incredible that you kind of pulled that off. I guess that was a lot of rehearsing and a lot of pre-production meetings, working out who was going to do what when.
Yeah, totally. That's what we worked on for, I don't know how long. The Fab Four is going on 20 years now, and we recorded that, I think, back in 2010. And the deal with the Fab Four is, you know, we try to get it as close as we can to the album, to the recordings. So there was a lot of shuffling with figuring out who's going to play what. Can I play this tambourine right after I play the guitar? Can I pick up the guitar and, you know, right after I play this piano bit? And it's one of my favorite performances to do because of all the coordination that takes place in executing the second side of that record. But it's exhilarating, the rush that you get, because it's sequential from one piece to the next on how you're coordinating your moves and you're also coordinating your vocals. You're trying to just be in tune as much as you can and just trying to be in the same rhythm as the rest of the band. It's something that we worked on. I can't tell you how long we worked on it for. But to give you another example, the Fab Four, this is the 50th anniversary of the White Album, and we've been playing the White Album quite a bit this year. And it used to take us just one day to rehearse Revolution Number 9. And now we kind of know it like the back of our hands. So when we get together for a performance, we just use the sound check to kind of just tweak it a bit. Not saying that, well, don't take it for granted. It still takes a lot of work on each one of us to at home to do the homework.
So, what's the most kind of complex piece when piecing that together?
It's probably getting out of Mean Mr. Mustard, with the downbeat of Polythene Pam. Because I'm doing the piano bit and I have the acoustic guitar in my lap. And I'm trying to use a sustain pedal on the piano to hold down the last note, or at least close to the last note on the piano, so I can get the downbeat on Polythene Pam. And then from that point on, the adrenaline just keeps building, because then we're going in, she came through the bathroom window, and I'm dropping the acoustic guitar and picking up the percussion in order to do the lead vocal. And I have to say, whether it's been playing with Rufus Wainwright in the past or other jobs that I do that are musically challenging, the fact that I've been listening to the Beatles since I was 5 years old, that stuff is so part of my DNA that I kind of rely on that, you know? I mean, I still have to work on rehearsing it and making sure my vocals are in tune and whatever else instrumentally. But it's one of the things that, and I would think a lot of your listeners, including yourself, you'd be surprised, because you've listened to that music so much that you would kind of know where to go.
And another piece of music by the Beatles that you actually nail yourself personally on vocals, which is a song I think McCartney has never played live, is Oh Darling.
I'm not sure if he did or not.
Yeah, I don't think they've ever played it. They've ever played it live. And I think one of the reasons he's kind of cited is that it really rips out the vocals. And that might be the song that I know there was a period where he was trying to get a more gruff kind of rough sound. And he was kind of setting the alarm at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting straight out of bed, going straight to the studio and recording, so he'd get that kind of not warmed up vocal. How do you prepare your voice for that particular song? And how do you look after it afterwards? Because it's a real challenge for the throat.
Indeed it is. And as a singer, I grew up as an instrumentalist. I didn't start singing until I was probably in my early 20s. And certainly once the Fab Four started, I was in my late 30s. And that's when I really became more of a singer as opposed to a background singer. So up until about 5 years ago, I would just, light a candle and just go for it and see what would happen. But about 5 or 6 years ago, I started realizing, hey, my vocal cords are a muscle in the same way that my hands have muscles in them when I warm up to play piano or guitar. I need to warm up. I need to prepare. I need to take care of those vocal cords. So there's a great app by Arnold McCullough. It's called Vocal Ease. And I got turned on to this app, and I use it on a regular basis. And it strengthens by practicing your vocals on a regular basis, you're strengthening your vocal cords. So if my allergies are acting up or I may have a cold, I can kind of go out there and have more confidence that I'm going to be able to deliver that piece than if I wasn't doing it.
Wow. So that's an interesting answer. So there's a particular app that's helped you through that. And what about afterwards? Are you feeling it afterwards? Is there pain in your throat? Because it does sound like a vocal that could lead to that.
Well, for me, I had to learn how to sing it from my chest, because if I start singing it from my throat, it could be over with really quick and I might not be able to nail. I know McCartney, as great of a singer as he is, I'm sure that was a combination of throat and as well as chest, for him. Maybe it was more throat on certain days because he couldn't sing afterwards. He had to go in the morning at the studio, do it and just be done with it. But for me, as long as I'm not suffering from allergies or don't have a cold, what I usually would do afterwards to warm down is have a glass of wine.
always the best way. And is it true that McCartney knows of the existence of Fab Four and has spoken to you guys before? Is that right?
He does. He does. As a matter of fact, Will has had the honor and pleasure of working with Sir Paul a number of times. And the first time that Will had worked with Paul, Will nonchalantly just said to Paul, "I have to tell you that I have a Beatle band, a Beatle tribute band. We don't dress up, but we really try to play the music as close as we can to the records." And Paul turned to Will and asked him, "Do you guys do Tomorrow Never Knows?" And Paul said, "As a matter of fact, we do." And then Paul said, "Well, you must be pretty good then." So, yeah.
Excellent. And when you're playing those songs, and your responsibility, if you like, your measure of success is how accurately you replicate a lot of that stuff. Is there a frustration when you're playing those songs in a way that the creative element in yourself can't be seen in those songs, because you actually just, you know, you really need to replicate exactly what's on the record, I'm guessing?
Well, I think this is one of the charms of the Fab Four. There's a lot of really good Beatle bands out there, and you know, even there's plenty of good Beatle bands that dress up and they nail it so well. We certainly nail it in the same way, but we also, there's certain liberties at times that we allow ourselves to have creatively, and it could be at the end of While My Guitar Gently Weeps that Jimmy Vivino gets to take an extended solo. There could be certain things like that, but ultimately, regardless, even by just copying the music as close as we can and playing it like the record and not having the space to be as creative as, say, another band, there's a beauty in that, as if there's a beauty in replicating Mozart or Bach in a chamber orchestra or in a symphony. It's like, hey, you know, this is some of the greatest music that's been written in the world, and it's an honor to try to replicate that. You know, there's other projects that I do that allow for more creativity in that respect.
One of which I'm guessing is, you mentioned earlier the complexities of some of the music working with Rufus Wainwright, and I love Rufus Wainwright. The One album and or the double album and Release the Stars are albums that are close to my heart. Tell us about that working relationship. Where did that begin, and what songs have you either performed on or worked with him on?
Yeah, I started working with Rufus in 1999. I came in halfway through the tour of supporting his first album. And I was always attracted to his songwriting, his music. John Bryant produced that first album. And at that time, John Bryant was certainly had a significant amount to do with anything that he got his hands on. And I always thought it was for the better, what he did and what he brought to the situation musically. So I was attracted to that first record for a number of reasons. And when I got the call for audition and got the job, I was really happy. And then I didn't work with Rufus again until 2003, I think, was when Want 1 and Want 2 came out. And then I was asked to be in the band again. So I had toured that record, and then I ended up recording Release the Stars with him and doing that tour. And in the same way with the Fab Four, where you can feel like you're part of this grand orchestra, that's how I felt with Rufus. Rufus, creatively, on Release the Stars tour, there was a couple of moments when, as a guitar player, I could get to stretch out a bit. But Rufus is he's got a lot in his background, from rock to folk to classical to cabaret. But when you usually perform with him, he always likes it to be like the record. You know, he wants to hear those parts, and he might even want to hear parts that he didn't write for the record. Now he's hearing a part. He wants to hear that in the same way that you would have to replicate a classical piece. So being part of Rufus's gig, I in the same way always felt this is a gig for, you know, a higher echelon. Like, to be part of his musicality was always something that I always prided myself on, you know, to be good enough to be in his band.
Yeah, it's some of the music is very complex for I always find the album Release of Stars really interesting, because its elements, it is a pop album in some ways, but it's so complex and unusual time signatures, and there's moments it slows down and speeds up. And did you say you recorded that album or just toured that album with him?
Release the Stars I recorded with him.
Awesome. And tell us about what makes him unique to work with in a studio. What's something that you learned working with Rufus about recording techniques or what makes him unique?
Well, you know, what I just said about performing with him live, where it has to be by the note, like, oh, no, you need to play this note, you need to play that note. In the studio, he was very open to any of the musicians coming in with their own parts. And he was inviting to, like, yeah, that's part now of the song. So when we go out and play it live, you need to play that what you played on the record or something like it. So I didn't expect that. So given the opportunity, you know, I had certain solos or certain parts that I just ended up coming up with on my own that was like, wow, that's cool. That made it on the record in a way that I thought he was. I mean, he certainly had suggestions or he had ideas on what he wanted, but there was that creative room on the record to be yourself, which was great.
And was it just guitar you played on that record? Did you play keyboards, or can you?
I played a piano on Katona, which was part of the recording sessions, but I think that was left off the record for something else. From what I remember, yeah. Yeah.
And what about kind of touring with Rufus? So you played on the Want tour, you said as well, which has an incredible song on there called The Art Teacher, which I'm doubting you played on because I think it's just him playing piano and singing on his own. What were your highlights of touring with him or particular songs that you enjoy playing with Rufus?
Well, as a matter of fact, there was a time we were doing an arrangement of The Art Teacher with the band.
Oh, wow.
And at some point on that tour, we ended up recording to tape a concert or two that never came out. And I know the engineer who did that. And there were times when I would be over his place and he goes, do you remember this? And he would put on The Art Teacher of the band playing it. And I used to do this like wah-wah part on it. You wouldn't think that was fitting, but it was really cool. So I did get to play on The Art Teacher, but watching Rufus and hearing him do it on his own too was just mesmerizing. Beautiful Child was always fun. Picture Show, was there something? I'm trying to remember. Release the Stars was great because I got to play piano on that, and that was a nice feature. Anything I got to play mandolin on, I always enjoyed. With Rufus, there was a song I think called "The Greek Boy Off Poses." There was also something off the first record that was a little bit more complicated. I'm not remembering the name of that one. But besides the playing with Rufus, you know, there was always the dance. One of the things that we started doing—I don't know if you saw any of the tours that happened—but there was starting with the tour of Want One. There was always some sort of theatrics that got involved in the show, and it ended up on at least two, if not three tours. We had to have a choreographer come to the rehearsals and for like 3 days teach us a dance to one of these tunes. So that was always interesting. And at times there might be, you know, a mess up or two and you got reprimanded. You never got fined. But it would be the kind of thing is like, I think you're messing up and you might be doing it on purpose. Like, nope. I'm just not a good dancer.
Cool. So we talked about recording techniques a little bit there. We touched upon, you know, Rufus in the studio. I know that you've recently been working with Joan Osborne, and you recently said that for a recording that you've done, that you went back to tape. Why was that?
Are you referring to the last Joan album?
Yeah. You went back to tape, I believe.
I'm 53 years old, so I come from an analog world. Not that other 53-year-olds don't come from an analog world and transition to digital, and certainly I have transitioned to digital myself, but I've always been more comfortable in that environment. And I can certainly work a recording console and work the outboard gear more than I can a Pro Tools session. That being said, I also think that analog tape just sounds great, and I love that it sets limitations for the band when you're recording, because you can't have 10 takes of a song. The most we ever did were 3 takes of a song because you just didn't have that much tape. And if you have the right band, that should be good enough. There's also the fact that after you record a song or two and you want to listen to it back, you have to put your headphones down and go in the control room and listen to it. There is a certain work ethic and process that happens that I think is more relaxing. And it's so great to listen to a playback and not look at a computer screen. Like, just look at the tape reel spinning or something else, you know? So I have co-produced Joan's last three albums, and each of those records, if not all, then at least the majority of it, were done analog onto a tape machine.
Do you think there's a risk that in the digital age, and as you say, you're doing unlimited takes, that the skill level could drop generally across musicians because they aren't being challenged enough to do things in a particular amount of takes?
You know, this is something that comes up in more than one discussion when talking about working digitally as opposed to in an analog environment. You know, I think if you have a great song, you record it, it's going to be phenomenal no matter what you record it on. If there's a good musician playing on it, you know, it doesn't matter what. However, you know, I do think that something is lost, in the same way that I'm sure, you know, in the 1960s or 70s, if you spoke to an artist in their 50s, they would say, oh, well, you know, these kids have it so easy, because back then, you know, all we could do was one take. And if you didn't get it, you had to like do the acetate again before there was tape. I have one of my favorite things in the world as far as music goes is I have a 1947 RCA Victrola. It's electric. And I collect 78s. And when I listen to music on that Victrola, I'm hearing the musicians and the singers in one take. There might be more than one mic, but I'm hearing, you know, whether it's the Mills Brothers, whether it's Elvis Presley, whether it's Fats Waller, Dinah Washington, those are performances that I'm sure if you compare the level of musicianship in the 1940s to the level of musicianship in the 1970s or 80s, it probably diminished. I think with anything in the course of decades that are being passed, that the talent becomes diminished. That doesn't mean to say that there's not great artists out there, because there is. But I do think that with the convenience of having a computer and the music business being oversaturated, it's great that anybody can make music, and they should. But I also think that, you know, to an extent, it weakens the level of skill that one might attain if you didn't have these conveniences.
And you talked about co-production techniques there. Do you have any particular things up your sleeve to get people into the right headspace? Are there any unusual things that you've done to try and get people into the right headspace to do to really nail a recording?
Well, whenever we've done these recordings at my old studio in Pennsylvania, always made sure there was good food, good wine, things along, and just a pleasant environment. I think when you work in an environment like that you don't see the clock running, and people can eat together and they can socialize together and they just don't show up and do a session, I think that makes for a relaxed environment. You know, what also helps too is that I sometimes make a playlist of songs to be of inspiration, that, you know, we might listen to that before a recording session, or we might listen to it afterwards. So I think having albums around that inspire you when you're in a recording environment is a good idea.
What would you do if you're working with someone and they just go, I've got a blank sheet, I've got nowhere to go, other than playing records that might influence them?
That's a good question. And I would say, you know, if that's happening, then the next day you get together with that person, let's just take the first 5 minutes and not even think. Let's just pick up an instrument and play and just see what happens. You're bound to get something, you know, worth expanding upon. That doesn't mean it might be the finished song that you're looking for. But as I mentioned earlier, with your vocals, even writing is a muscle that, you know, I think you need to work on in order to come up with ideas quickly.
Sometimes artists have difficulty handing over their songs that they've written to a producer. How do you appease any anxieties they might have? Because you're kind of giving ownership over, if you like, to a producer. Have you experienced that before, and how do you appease those anxieties?
Well, I like to think of myself more as a co-producer when I'm working with an artist, because ultimately it's their decision. I've been in situations where I've tried to talk an artist out of something, and it's just not going to happen because they're too attached to their music, and they've put a lot of time and effort into getting it to this place. So they're not ready to let it go, and it's not worth it for me to debate them on it. If they're that passionate about it, it's their record. They're paying me to do a job. And I don't mean to like just say, well, I give up, but ultimately it's their decision. I may voice my opinion, but it's their decision. So
have you been in situations where a record company perhaps are telling you as a producer, this is what we want from this artist's record? And so when you say that the artist in that example has the final say, and you go along with it and you can only try and influence them, has there been a case where you've ever kind of been stuck in the middle, and how would you deal with that if that came up?
Yeah, I haven't been in that situation because usually the artist is in on that conversation if that happens. So it's nobody like taking me aside and saying, listen, you know, you need to get that artist to, you know, change their mind on this or that. It's like, you know, the way the music business has been lately, maybe if that was however many years ago, it might be like that. But I've never been in that situation, thankfully, because as I said, you know, it's the artist's name on the album, and ultimately it's their decision. You know, if I'm hired for it, I'm hired for it to a certain degree, but I'm also hired to be that voice of reason and that voice of listening. We all know stories where either the record company or the producer has had arguments with the artist. And, you know, maybe the record company was right, probably not so. Maybe the producer was right about certain things, but ultimately it's not going to change the world. You know, I mean, I'd rather the artist just be happy with what's happening and respect what I can bring to the project, and so be it, just let it go from there.
You've worked with some of the most successful artists that they've been around in the last kind of 20 to 30 years. Out of personality traits that set aside professional musicians, you know, the real the top musicians you've worked with, from those who are on the ladder on the way up, what are the common personality traits or skill sets that they have that the people on the way up might benefit from learning?
Dedication. Just dedication and more dedication, certainly knowing yourself and knowing what you want from your songs and your career. But ultimately, a certain drive, that means that, you know, certain things come up in one's life that you have to honor, life situations, of course, but, you know, beyond that, you're not going to let anything get in the way of you finishing and reaching your vision.
Let's talk a bit about live performances now. You've done some quite high profile shows in the past. How would you advise someone to excel in high pressure environments? What do they need to be doing less of or more of to excel in high pressure environments when the spotlight's really on?
Yeah. I never myself really get into situations where I've been nervous. There was a time when touring with Rufus where he asked me, because he knew me, he knows me as a guitar player, as a singer, as a mandolin player, and as a keyboard player. But when he was doing the live Judy show, the next tour after that was, I think it was Release the Stars, and he asked me to learn a couple of the pieces that he was doing in the live Judy show, and it was really challenging for me, because I'm not that kind of piano player. I'm not a jazz piano player, or I'm not a cabaret piano player, and those songs require that vocabulary and that navigation of the piano. But, you know, I hired a jazz teacher, piano teacher, and I sat there for a couple months and I worked on it, and it was great for me. It was great for my piano playing. However, you know, once I was put into a live situation, I never had the experience of playing that stuff live. So, you know, there were certainly moments when I was, you know, praying to my ancestors that had left this planet a while ago, you know, to like just smile down upon me for, you know, playing in front of, you know, thousands of people with just Rufus and I on the stage. But, you know, the thing is, one of the things that I always told me in that situation was, it's just music, you know. People, there's nobody out there that's not on your side. And the last thing that you want in 10 years from now is to look back at this moment and say you didn't enjoy yourself. So, you know, if you're aspiring to be on the stage and you get on the stage and you start to get nervous, I don't know that that's going to help, but it's definitely something good to think about. It's like, man, I want to have fun here. This is, you know, being in the place I always wanted to be. And these people want to celebrate this with me. It's not like they're looking for me to fail, you know? So I think you can kind of switch it in your head a little bit.
What do you think of the common denominator to the great gigs? If you think of the, you know, your top four or five concerts you've ever played, what was the common theme that was running through them?
The common theme, wow, this is happening. You know, I'm getting to, you know, play Madison Square Garden. I'm opening up for The Who in 1996 with Joan Osborne for Quadrophenia. Or, you know, I'm getting to play Glastonbury with Rufus Wainwright or Patti Smith, or, you know, I'm playing with Ian Hunter, you know, making music. I'm playing, you know, in the Fab Four, that's playing some of the greatest music in the world. The theme that just runs through my head, it just brings a smile to my face. It's like, I'm very lucky that I get to do this. There's so many talented people out there, and it takes a lot, man. It takes a lot to be prepared for a situation like that and have the skills, but then it takes a little bit of luck and being in the right place and being prepared to, like, you know, and then you're there and you're doing it. So that's kind of what goes through my head. And then I'm like, how much more money can I make? Can I ask for a raise? No.
And given that, I mean, you obviously don't suffer from nerves, and you get yourself into a good mindset. What is the biggest thing or biggest two or three things that have gone wrong at live shows, and how did you deal with it at the time? How did you overcome them?
Biggest things that could have gone wrong would be some sort of musical mistake that you can't get yourself out of. You know, I have to say that getting back to that experience of playing those piano pieces with Rufus, you know, I probably played them, I'm going to say, like, you know, 50 times in the course of a year-long tour. And there was maybe one or two times where I just fell off the tracks. And it was all of a sudden, you know, the piano has been drinking, and, you know, Rufus is looking at me like, what's going on here? And it just, because it wasn't in my wheelhouse, as if I was on guitar, to be different. So, you know, there was a situation that, how do I get out of that? You know, eventually I do.
If you were backed into that corner and you were going down the wrong tracks, what did you do?
What really helps is, again, like being prepared. So if your mind wanders or you got distracted, if you're prepared, you know, you rely on muscle memory too, which helps your hands to get into a certain place. So, you know, what did I do? Eventually I got back to where I should have been. But I mean, that's just like one situation. I mean, other things could be technical that are beyond your control. And that just is what it is. So, you know, you don't want to be in that situation if you can help it, but if it happens, you know, you move on. I was just reading, I'm reading the Bruce Springsteen biography, Born to Run, which is great. And he just talked about one part, where Nils Lofgren got in the band, and it was when the stadium and arena tours started happening. And on the first song that Nils Lofgren came out to play on the tour, he totally botched the solo. And it's a memory that, you know, they all can laugh about, but I mean, Nils Lofgren is a fine musician, and the rest of the show was seamless, right? But yeah, you don't want to be remembered for that one bad thing that you did out of all, like, the 99 times you nailed it, right? So just have a sense of humor about it.
Another artist that you worked with, I actually saw perform live last Sunday supporting Nick Cave. It was wonderful. It was Patti Smith. How did the relationship work with Patti? Did you tour with her, or did you do recordings with her? What was the working relationship there?
The bass player in that band, Tony Shanahan, and I go way back. And when there was a chance, when that guitar chair was vacant, he had brought me in. And that was in 2006. And from 2006 to 2016, a good 10 years, I toured and recorded with Patty and the band. And it was a lifetime experience. She is like no other. And that band's chemistry with her is like no other. You know, the complete opposite in ways of Rufus musically. I don't walk away from Patti Smith's gig thinking I'm a better musician as I would with Rufus's gig, but I get something completely different out of that show. I wouldn't think of Patti so much as a musician as I would as a poet and an actor, and how she delivers her performance. It's unstoppable. So I recorded 3 albums with her. And, you know, toured the world with her. We played in Glastonbury. She would play huge festivals in Europe, played in front of thousands of people. We'd also do small intimate shows as well. But there's just something in what she does that I don't think very few people have that.
What is that?
I think that's somebody that just really knows themselves and knows what they're doing and understands communication with an audience and can deliver that. I would watch her on stage to communicate in front of thousands of people. She could lead a revolution at that moment. You know, what is it about somebody like that that can do that? That's a gift. That's a gift. You know, not to say that she doesn't have her faults or she's not human, because we all are. But when somebody is able, I mean, I don't know if you've ever read any of her books, but she's one of my favorite authors. She has a way of speaking to the masses, but yet you think she's speaking to you. In the same way, that's so great about the Beatles, is that Beatles can be an experience that everybody can participate in, yet you can individualize that so much, and that this makes it, all the greats have that in any sort of art form. So that was a real privilege, really, to be part of her band for that. And they just released a live concert that we did. It was the last concert of the Horses tour that just came out last week. I haven't seen it, but you know, I don't know, it'd be the same as being there, but it's pretty cool.
But what would an artist learn from working with Patty that, apart from that, that they wouldn't necessarily learn from working with anyone else?
I don't know. It's anything that's different than working with other artists. I'd like to answer your question as best as I can. I think there's a similarity that you need to be yourself. You need to allow yourself to be yourself in any situation, because I think, you know, whether it's Patty or Rufus, it's not just your playing, it's who you are as a person. And Patty's music is not complicated by any means. And a lot of people would listen to that and say, I can do that. And, you know, there were other guitar players before me, obviously, and guitar players to come. But there with Patty, there is a refinement, because she doesn't have a big musical vocabulary. She appreciates that you might, but she doesn't want that to get in the way of her words and her presentation as an artist. So if there's one thing from Patty that reinforced kind of what I do, and I still hold on to it, is that less is more. You know, no matter, as you're a musician and you're part of a band, you know, we all learn this at some point or another in our careers. It's like, you don't need to play everything you know in that first solo. Save it. Pay attention to what the artist is doing. And that was the thing with Patty. It's like, I always had to watch her, because she didn't communicate as a musician on stage. So you had to watch her moves, her body moves. You had to watch her head moves. And you had to pay attention to certain signals that, you know, she would give you or somebody else in the band for dynamics or this and that. And it didn't necessarily mean you were doing anything wrong or right, it was just how she was perceiving it. So that was something that I learned from her and being in that band, is just, you know, pay attention. Don't just go off and do something that maybe is not necessary.
That's a fantastic answer. Thank you. And You're obviously a gifted and celebrated musician, Jack. What bad habits do you have that you would teach a young musician not to do?
Bad habits. Well, bad habits. I don't know. I mean, we all have to figure that out to some extent. If it was going to be technical and had to do with music, I would say, let's talk about good habits. I think good habits are learning as many different styles of music that you can and be open to different styles of music. Good habits are practicing and listening every day and trying to stay inspired. Good habits are being in an environment with other musicians, and even if you're listening and particularly don't like maybe the way one person is playing, try to find something that person is doing that you do like. Because the more, and I'm not saying that just to like compliment people for the sake of complimenting people, but I think the more that you can enjoy an experience with somebody, the more it's going to open up doors. And it might not happen right there and then. It might happen a year from now. It might happen 5 years from now. But that's just what I mean. That's a good habit, to stay open. So bad habits are doing everything the opposite of what I just said, of closing yourself off. Something I never did. in my bad habits, I don't know. I mean, I have them, but I can't give you any at the moment. I'm sure they're there, but I'm not going to dwell on them. I'm going to move on and not carry the guilt.
Okay, so what about things like, what's the biggest price that you pay for this job? So a lot of people, you know, being a professional musician, doing what you're doing, it seems like the dream job. It's everything most people would want to do who's a musician. What are the things that we don't see? What are the difficulties that we don't see that perhaps might be a challenge that aren't so visible to everybody?
You know, I suppose you might get similar answers to that question, or different answers to that question, depending on the age of that person, depending on their own experiences. I think, you know, I've missed weddings, I've missed funerals, things like that, being away. However, there's more. It has been a dream job, and you know, I can't count my blessings enough, the fact that I've been able to do this and make a living doing it. So I wouldn't discourage anybody from trying to do it, that's for sure. But things have changed so much in the music business, in the world in general. I think you need to be prepared to have different assets these days than just to be a fine musician. And if your podcast is going out to younger people, then I'm sure those people probably have a one-up on me in that, you know, they've gotten Ableton together, they've gotten other programs, software together that they can incorporate into their musicianship that will help them get hired. And I think that's, you know, I was just having a conversation with somebody the other day that was telling me, oh yeah, well this guy does this and that guy does that. And even one of the things this guy was doing was renting PA equipment, because he's trying to stay in the business as much as he can, you know. And the internet's great, but you know, the internet has also, unfortunately, taken away a lot of jobs. You know, whether it's studios, music is free now. So, you know, even for me, all the co-writes that I have on records or the producing that I've done on albums, you know, if it was 20 years ago, it would be three times the amount of money that I'm making right now. That's just because music is free and, you know, I'm not going to get the same residuals that I did back then. So it's more about, you know, people that are coming up now it's bad habits. It's just trying to create as many good habits as you can with what you're doing.
Now you got to the level that you want to, I'm guessing, and you've got a certain level of success and credibility and acclaim for what you've done. What's your motivation now? What do you want to be doing next? What are your ambitions that you have left?
I want to keep doing what I'm doing. I want to keep writing music. I want to keep producing music. I want to keep playing music. I want to, this is one of the beautiful things about music and art, is that you can constantly keep growing. So I just hope to keep growing and hope to keep staying inspired and finding other avenues to work in music. And that's my goal. I just last year put out my own album. It's under the title of Jack Snacks, JACKSNAX. And, you know, it's on Spotify, it's on CD Baby. And that was a great experience for me. So I'm currently, you know, working on music for the next album. And I've started to perform that out live, and that's been very rewarding. So, you know, not that I thought about it in the past, but I did it. I finally got around to doing it. And my motivation for that was just love to be in the studio. I love creating with people. I'm trying to finally do something on my own. So, I will continue to write and record my own music as well.
Reflecting back on your career, how did it pan out differently? Now you probably looked at the beginning of the music industry, this is where I want to be, this is what I want to do. How does that align, those ambitions you had then to now where you are? How closely do they align? How did it pan out differently to what you expected it to be?
Well, I didn't get in Led Zeppelin, so... So it kind of didn't work out like I thought it would, but I'm not complaining.
There's still time. We'll begin to wrap up. Just a couple of last questions. What's your most important piece of memorabilia that you own?
You know, I said it earlier, that 1947 RCA Victrola.
Nice.
I have about 200 78s, and I still bid on 78s. There is an incredible auction house out of Texas that sends me every few months a new catalog, and those 78s are becoming more and more rare and more expensive, but that's a time machine. I put those 78s on that Victrola, as I'm sure a lot of people feel about vinyl, and I feel that way about vinyl too, but these 78s, it's the closest I feel I could ever get to actually being in the room with Elvis Presley or the Mills Brothers. It's just this little 6-inch speaker, but the way that it was recorded and the way that I'm hearing it, that's memorabilia. That's nostalgia to me. It's beautiful.
It's great to hear your passion talking about that. And what are the kind of classic stories you think in the future you'll look back and, you know, tell your grandchildren or your proudest moments? Are there any kind of that really spring to mind?
Well, I got to see The Last Supper in Milan. I think the experiences of music, I don't know that you can convey that unless somebody understands that passion for that. I'll never take that for granted, that I could play music with other people and communicate in that way. And the joy of feeling that and sharing that with the musicians and an audience is really special. But, you know, it's the lifetime experiences that as people that happen around making music that are very memorable. So I like to think about the friendships that I've made along the way and with people that I feel very connected with. And then also, you know, I got to perform with Joan Osborne with Pavarotti.
Wow.
In Milan in 1996, 97. Steve Gadd was in the band. Pino Palladino was in the band and a host of others. But Elton John, Eric Clapton, Sheryl Crow, Liza Minnelli, Zucchera, and a few others that I'm not thinking of at the moment were on that bill. And, you know, I mean, that was with a 60-piece orchestra playing the organ at Radio City Music Hall when the Fab Four sold out a show there, playing like the House Wurlitzer organ that I always used to see somebody play as a kid when I went there. you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, playing Madison Square Garden, things like that, that, you know, when you're a kid, you like think about doing that, and they happen. But ultimately, it's, you know, it's the experiences that revolve around that and the people that you meet and the relationships that you make.
Fast forward from 30 years from now, if you can put your mind in your future self, what would your future self be advising you to do differently right now, do you think, if anything at all?
Man, if I knew that, oh God, if I knew that, I mean, think about that, right? That's incredible. If you could, even if I was to go back 30 years, 53 being 23, like what would I advise myself not to do or to do? Because I think things have worked out pretty good. So, man, what would I tell myself? I don't know. Jesus, I don't know. But maybe, you know, if I could do that, it would, you know, have the names to some horse races or something. Like, go bet on this horse.
great answer. Okay, and the final question, because I know we got to wrap up now. What fears do you have for the music industry, if any, and how might those fears be addressed?
It might be too late, but the fears of the music industry is like what I sort of talked about earlier. Music's free, and you know, some people see that as a good thing, and it's really not. You know, you're not going to ask a plumber to come into your house and fix your plumbing for free. And I think that, unfortunately, not that record companies are good companies necessarily, but at least there was money there to develop and nurture artists that's not happening now. In the same way, you know, how would you fix the economy? How can you fix the music business at this point? I don't know that you can. I think it's going to, like anything, it's going to change into something else. So, you know, I can only hope that at the very base of that, that there'll be people that just play their instruments and sing and play well. I don't know at this point, you know, that music is going to become anything more different than what it is or what it has been. I think that, you know, rock and roll has peaked. I think so many styles have peaked. There's going to be nothing new. However, you can't deny a good song of three chords and a great melody and a great story. So I'm sure that will continue to happen. But I don't know that we can get the music business back on the rails that it should be. But if I could, if there was something to change, I would hope that something would change along the means of what proper residual should be for music that's being sold, and that it wouldn't be free. And, you know, I'm just as guilty of it as the next person. I have a Spotify account, but I still buy music and I still support artists, and I think that's important.
Wise words. Okay, well, thank you so much, Jack, for your wisdom, your insight. Keep up your amazing work. Best of luck on the future projects. We urge listeners to check out the solo stuff that you're doing as well. And we hope you enjoyed appearing on the Stage Left podcast.
Yeah, I have. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.